Today on Against the Grain, we investigate the ideas of Mahatma Gandhi, in particular what he thought about truth and how to attain it, self-discipline and how to practice it, political independence and how to achieve it, and modern civilization and how to understand it. I'm CS. The political theorist Manu Samnotra shares his insights into Gandhian thought and practice coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Mohandas Gandhi is a gigantic figure, a deep and dazzling thinker whose insights fueled not just India's drive for independence from British rule, but countless subsequent struggles for social justice and political emancipation. And yet, how much clarity do we have about Gandhi's ideas and what they meant for achieving truth, for mastering our desires, for acting ethically in the face of oppression? What was Gandhi searching for, and what avenues did he choose to take in that quest? And what did Gandhi think about modern civilization and how it affected people's thoughts and actions? Manu Samnotra has contributed an enlightening chapter about Gandhian thought and practice to the new volume Constructing the Pluriverse, The Geopolitics of Knowledge. Manu is assistant professor of political theory in the School of Interdisciplinary Global Studies at the University of South Florida. His chapter has the title, Experimenting with Freedom, Gandhi's Political Epistemology. When Manu Samnotra joined me recently, I asked him what he was trying to do with this chapter.
So the invitation that I received from the editor, Bernd Reiter, was that he wanted us to think, the contributors to the volume, to think about ways of organizing knowledge in non-Western context. And so the challenge was to try to think through, for I think all the contributors, how non-Western ways of organizing knowledge can open doors to decolonial practices. So, for example, if you think of knowledge only in terms of scientific rationality, what do we miss? What political avenues are closed to us? And so, Bernd, my colleague here at USF, invited me to write something about Gandhi, and I thought this was a very interesting opportunity and challenge, because Gandhi is not a systematic thinker. He is someone who is interested in political practice, although he wrote quite a bit. His collected works run to, I think, about 98 volumes, and each of which is about 400 to 500 pages long. So here's someone who is not a systematic thinker, and yet has been exceptionally influential, not only in India, but also internationally, in shaping a political practice that tends to flip the script on the ways in which the colonizers or the oppressors against whom the practice of civil disobedience was applied wanted to organize the political field.
How important to Gandhi was the search for truth?
I think truth was absolutely fundamental to Gandhi's political epistemology. He called himself a votary of truth, and he referred to truth as the summum bonum of life. Now, truth, however, is a pretty expansive concept, even in Western philosophy. In Gandhi's case, however, truth is multifaceted. So let's say for the moment, when I say, but Gandhi says that he's a votary of truth, let's imagine the big truth, truth encompassing all of human existence, as starting with a capital T. But Gandhi also understood that truth is multifaceted. All of us have access to a small sample of that larger truth. And so when we engage in dialogic conversations with each other, when we try and approach each other with goodwill to understand what the causes of political disagreement are, we come closer to the larger truth. If we were to access the larger truth, and Gandhi firmly believed this, we would discover that we are all part of one human family, that the distinctions and differences between us are ephemeral. They have real consequences and they have real substance behind them, real histories behind them. But these differences, these chasms that separate us, are themselves dependent on a larger truth that we are all part of one family, one human family. and perhaps in Gandhi's case sometimes, because he was a vegetarian, also a non-human family as well. All beings are united together.
Now, at least one word in Hindi for truth is satya, and that brings us to one of his key concepts, his notion, satyagraha. What does that term as a whole mean literally, and what did it mean to Gandhi?
So the term satyagraha was a neologism. So Gandhi is in South Africa, where he has gone as a lawyer, and he's involved in the, at this point, early stages of the anti-apartheid movement. And the form of protest that he develops is entirely novel. And the closest analogs that he can find to it are the terms passive resistance or civil disobedience. Of course, he prefers the latter, but passive resistance is the one that is nearly always used to define what he is doing. And in fact, many years later, when he came back to India, reporters from the New York Times describing the practice of satyagraha could not help but accentuate its passive elements. So just to give you an example, waves after waves of satyagrahis walk up to baton-wielding policemen who strike them on the head, and the satyagrahis don't respond. So to the Western eyes, that seemed like a certain kind of passivity. Gandhi did not like that, because Gandhi thought that there's something very active at the core of what he was advocating in South Africa and then later in India. And so he, in his local newspaper that he had started, he asked his readers to recommend a name. And I will not go into the other history of it, but basically he comes up with, alongside the contribution of other people, he comes up with the word satyagraha. Now, as you mentioned, satyagraha is a compound word of satya, which means truth, and agraha, which means firm grasping. And so together, they are meant to indicate a firm grasping of the truth, or sometimes, as he referred to it in his English writings, as truth force. Now, the word satya itself, and this is sort of ties to what I said earlier, the word satya itself is derived from the word sat, which means being. So to give you an example, if you look at the history of Western philosophy in Plato and Parmenides, the idea is that being comes before non-being. And the principle here is that if non-being came before being, non-being would annihilate being. So being has to have preference. And so for Gandhi, being has a certain kind of precedence over non-being. Truth has precedence over misleading interpretations of reality. And so when someone engages in satyagraha, they're insisting on the truth that I mentioned earlier, that we're all part of one human family. They're firmly insisting on this truth.
What does satyagraha have to do with dialogue and with the bringing together of different perspectives?
So dialogue is an integral part of satyagraha. So Gandhi once said that, quote, every case can be seen from no less than 7 points of view, all of which are probably correct by themselves, but not correct at the same time and in the same circumstances. So if truth is, as I mentioned earlier, multifaceted, and the satyagrahi is insisting on the truth, then in order to capture that capital T truth, the satyagrahi needs the corroboration of truth from other people. And so dialogue is fundamental to how a satyagrahi is able to actually capture or understand the truth that the satyagrahi claims to be insisting upon.
You write that for Gandhi, the first step in any satyagraha struggle is to discover the conditions one seeks to address and to look at those conditions from a number of perspectives, not just the perspective of the oppressed. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so this is kind of important because at some level, you know, Gandhi wants to make sure that if you're insisting upon the truth, you actually understand it in all its facets. So in hindsight, and of course we know this now, many of the moments in which he initiated a satyagraha movement, those instances, the truth or justice was on the side on behalf of whom Gandhi started this movement. But as an actor going into the situation, you do not know what the reality is. And so two things are important. One, you try to find out as much as you can about both sides of the situation. So for example, one of the first Satyagraha movements that India, that Gandhi starts in India, is in a village of Champaran, where the farmers are being forced to plant indigo and have to pay high taxes, and they are suffering as a result of the policies of the British government. So when Gandhi goes there, he tries to find out from all sides what the reality is. And of course, he finds out very quickly that, in fact, the farmers are the ones who are in the right. But that, besides that point, the other important thing that's happening here when the Satyagrahi tries to find out what everybody thinks is that he's trying to show his goodwill. He's trying to show that, look, I'm not here as an ideologue who's come in and have already, in my mind, set the terrain of a political disagreement in advance. I'm here to actually learn. And so I'm willing to be as persuaded by you as by the people who have called me in to help them organize their protests. And so it sort of sets, as a first movement, the terms by which the future struggle will follow. And in this case, it's by showing a certain kind of goodwill.
Yeah, and this is very profound because a lot of people who engage in a political struggle would tend to see the opposing side as the enemy and therefore not deserving of goodwill, not deserving of a kind of positive interest and maybe compassion.
Right. And so as a result, I mean, so I rely on the work of other very great Gandhi scholars. I have in mind the work of Karuna Mantena, who basically says that Gandhi is in some ways a realist. That, you know, we tend to think of Gandhi as an idealist who is, you know, attached to political principles that cannot possibly be implemented in the world as we actually have inherited it. But these other interpreters of Gandhi argue, and I think correctly, that Gandhi is actually quite aware that the terms by which we start a political dialogue, the terms by which the entire thing is set into motion, has to be done correctly. You have a greater chance of succeeding in your political aims if you are receptive to the aims of those against whom you're opposed. And so again, going back all the way to the idea of truth as being, you know, that we're all part of one human family, Gandhi believes at a spiritual level that he will not lose anything by learning about what other people think. He will actually gain a greater insight into the shared reality. And perhaps in the process, by showing this goodwill, he might actually persuade them that they too can learn about the shared reality and come to understand the people they're opposed to as, in fact, their allies in the future.
That's Manu Samnotra. He teaches in the School of Interdisciplinary Global Studies at the University of South Florida. And we are talking about an article he wrote about Gandhi's thought called Experimenting with Freedom that appears in the new volume Constructing the Pluriverse, not the universe, but the Pluriverse, The Geopolitics of Knowledge. It's edited by Bernd Reiter and published by Duke University Press. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. Ahimsa, which is, I think, typically translated as nonviolence. This is another notion prominently associated with Gandhi. What does goodwill, the goodwill you've been talking about, have to do with ahimsa?
So etymologically, the word ahimsa is a negation of the word himsa, which is harm. And ahimsa has two different aspects to it, a negative aspect and a positive aspect. So the negative aspect is fairly straightforward and simple enough to understand. If you want to practice ahimsa, if you want to practice nonviolence, then do not harm other beings. And this part of ahimsa is perhaps fundamental to every attempt at implementing the idea of civil disobedience. I'm not using the word satyagraha, the word civil disobedience here. Satyagraha, however, depends also upon the positive side of ahimsa, which is not only will I not harm you, I also want to show you love and compassion. And so this is part of the goodwill that is integral to how Gandhi advocated the practice of satyagraha. Not only is your well-being at the core of how I live my life, which is by not harming you physically, I further show you my concern for your good, for your well-being by showing you compassion and love. But that ultimately is what I am motivated by, and not by greed or desire, or selfish desire, or ideological inflexibility.
Yeah, and as you put it in another way in your article, although I like the way you just expressed it. There's a desire to do the opponent good. There's a desire for others' well-being.
Yes. And so certainly this is a very important facet of how Gandhi conducted his politics. Now, here I want to make a distinction between the idealized, in some ways, image of Gandhi that we have and how Gandhi himself would have been wished to be understood, and perhaps the a more skeptical but no less appreciative picture of Gandhi. So Gandhi wants to do good for the people who he thinks have been misled by, and we'll talk more about this, I hope, in a few moments, by modern civilization. And he wants to show them love. But it's a strict kind of love. It is not a love that says you can have whatever you want. It is a love that is premised on the belief that what you are doing is wrong for you, even though you don't know it. And it is my act of love for you that I'm going to show you that your path is wrong, and I'm going to resist the policies that you need to in order to pursue the path that you're on. And so it is not a lovey-dovey kind of love where everything goes. It is actually, in some ways, a very harsh kind of love that tries to wean the political opponent away from his or her reliance on violence.
What did Gandhi's asceticism have to do with his effort to cultivate goodwill toward his opponents, to desire the well-being of others who he may have disagreed with?
I think ascetic practices are at the core of Gandhi's politics. They are almost inseparable from them. And in fact, if you read even the most commonly read stuff by Gandhi, which is his autobiography and his book, The Hind Swaraj, and some other things here and there, he constantly talks about his various attempts at controlling his desires. Now, I'm going to sort of try to telescope this out to the larger question of ahimsa by starting somewhere else, which is, for Gandhi, passions are dangerous. They're dangerous because the hankering after things that passion generates and fuels makes us insensitive to a means and ends distinction. So the idea here is that if I am anxious for something and I want something and I really am hankering after it, at some point I will stop paying any kind of ethical attention to how those things are acquired. To give an example from our own contemporary politics, vegetarianism, something that Gandhi was very, very seriously committed to. Most of us, those of us who eat meat, love, you know, barbecue cookouts and burgers and, you know, chicken wings. Most of us also don't really want to know the processes through which this food becomes available to us. And so Gandhi is saying that if we give in to our desires, if we are driven by our desires, then we will become insensate to the processes by which the things that we want have become available to us. So what Gandhi wants us to do is to ask ourselves, why do we want something? And this is not something that we will learn entirely as the result of some kind of intellectual process. We actually have to live it. And so Gandhi advocates ascetic practices or an ascetic lifestyle in order to understand why we want something. And as a second step, and this is the core idea, in order to regain control over ourselves, to regain control over our desires. Because when we are in control of our desires, we are in a better position to understand where our desires come from. And then, now we've come to the more political, directly political point, we understand what is at stake in our disagreement with our political opponent. We understand why we want to have, you know, a certain end come about, because we are in better control of our desires. Whereas a political opponent, driven by her or his own desires, is unable to understand why they want the things that they want, and therefore are consistently occluding the very important distinction between means and ends.
Desires. Well, I know Gandhi had quite a bit to say about the extent to which desires, material desires, are fueled by civilization, by modern civilization. This is a big question, I know, but what did Gandhi think about modern civilization, and what was the fundamental target of his critique? What aspect of modern civilization did he not approve of?
So for me personally, this has always been the part of Gandhi that takes my breath away. The audacity almost of his intellectual gymnastics. And I think really well done gymnastics at that. Opens the space for political thinking in ways that I think most political thinkers that I've spent my time reading are unable to do. But in order to get at that, we have to first understand what civilization means for Gandhi. And so I'm going to quote from Gandhi here. Quote, "Civilization is that mode of conduct which points out to man the path of duty. Performance of duty and observance of morality are convertible terms. To observe morality is to attain mastery over our mind and our passions. So doing, we know ourselves." So when I say that it's the sheer audacity of what Gandhi is doing here is, when I say that, it's because by defining civilization in this way, Gandhi is able to flip the script, something I had mentioned earlier, on the dominant ideological narratives surrounding colonialism. I think, as most of your listeners would know, the colonial claim, at least in the case of the British Empire, the colonial claim was, we are civilized, you are children on the civilizational ladder, and through our tutelage, you too can be civilized. When the colonizer says that they are civilized and the Indians are not, what the colonizer believes is that the colonizer has modern industrial capitalism as the engine that will make civilization possible. Correspondingly, because the Indians lack in modern industrial capitalism, they are not civilized. And therefore, the task of civilization is to bring railroads and to bring modern medicine and modern education to Indians, to the benighted masses of India. When Gandhi defines or redefines civilization not as the things that will become available to us, the conveniences we will have, faster travel, better medical healthcare, more scientific education, when he says that's not what civilization is, but the performance of our duties and our moral sensibilities, when he says that's what civilization is, he is flipping the entire script. And what he's essentially saying is that modern civilization, as it's claimed by the British, operates on the principle of multiplying your desires. You want more things. You hanker after more things. If we redefine civilization not as the things that we want and the things that we claim a right to have, but the things that we must do, we draw a boundary around what is our due. And proceeding from that perspective, we are likelier to engage in other regarding behavior than we would if we were simply driven by the conveniences of modern civilization, as defined by the British.
That's the voice of Manu Samnotra, MANU SAMNOTRA. He's assistant professor of political theory at the University of South Florida, and he has contributed a chapter about Gandhi's thought to a new volume. It's called Constructing the Pluriverse, not universe, but Pluriverse, Pluriverse, The Geopolitics of Knowledge. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. In this chapter that you've written, you point to a book that Gandhi wrote. It's called Hind Swaraj, and he is, in a sense, talking back to or engaging with some of the revolutionary thinkers in India who wanted to achieve political independence in a certain kind of way, sometimes including violence. What did Gandhi in this text say about what he thought these revolutionary thinkers, or at least some of them, were in fact trying to do, which wasn't necessarily good for India?
So the text that you mentioned, Hind Swaraj, is one of the most important things that Gandhi wrote. And he wrote this in quite a bit of hurry on his way back from London, where he had gone to represent the case of the Indian workers living in South Africa. And while he was there, he met a number of people, some of whom would become very influential later on in Indian politics, including the founder, or the intellectual sort of founder, of the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, which is RSS, which is the parent, ideological parent body of the current ruling party in India, the BJP. And so all of these young men who are in London at the time meet Gandhi, who is effectively a nobody on the Indian political scene, because he's been living in South Africa for a few years at this point. And they're all taken in by what's happening around them. For one, they are quite taken in by the Japanese model of industrialization. They think that Japan has found a way by which to respond to the challenges of the colonial imbalance of power. They have industrialized, and now they are able to respond as equals to Europe. Also within Europe, there are various political movements, especially in Italy, that these young revolutionaries are quite taken in by. And when Gandhi meets them, for the first time, he encounters an ideological position very clearly stated that is completely contrary to his own. And so on the ship journey back, he writes this text, which is in the form of a dialogue between an editor, which is meant to represent Gandhi's own position, and a reader, which is meant to represent the position of the young men that he encountered in London. And the conversation is about how does India gain independence? What do we do? And the reader says we need to basically become like the English. And that's how we will end up getting Swaraj. The word Swaraj means self-rule. Swa means self and Raj meaning rule. And as always, here too, Gandhi flips the script. And he says, look, your understanding of Swaraj is completely wrong. You think Swaraj is simply about kicking out the British and taking over what they leave behind. One beautiful line in this text, he says, quote, in effect, your proposal means this, that we want English rule without the Englishman. You want the tiger's nature, but not the tiger. That is to say, you would make India English, and when it becomes English, it will be called not Hindustan, but Englistan. This is not the Swaraj that I want. So Gandhi is saying independence, self-rule, requires a total rethinking of the political mechanisms and the political institutions and the political motivations that guide the Indians who hope to be independent. And this rethinking starts at the very basic level of how we understand our own desires. And so what colonialism has done very well is that it has made all of these things, all of the gifts of modern civilization, easily available to Indians. One of the examples is cheaper cloth. The factories in Lancashire are sending cotton products back to India, and now Indians have cheaper clothing available to them. What the people who buy this clothing don't realize is that the success of Lancashire, the mills in Lancashire, their success is premised on the impoverishment of the local producers in India. And so Gandhi is saying, without rethinking what it is that we want, you will not actually get independence. You have actually entered the tiger's domain and you simply want to ride the tiger. But the tiger will actually end up eating you if you don't rethink what self-rule actually means.
What did Gandhi know about the working conditions of industrial workers in Britain? And what did that say to him about the level of civilization that Britain actually could lay claim to?
So Gandhi was somewhat familiar. I mean, he was in London as a law student, the University College London, I think. And so he had lived in London for some time, and he had seen, this was 19th century London, so it's, you know, pretty grim. And so he's seen some the working conditions and factory life there, and he's read stuff about this. And his worry is that the motivations that have been guiding the British have lost touch with this definition of civilization that I mentioned earlier that he gave, which is premised on duties. Rather than thinking about their duties to each other, the British have made rational calculation the mechanism by which they evaluate their own progress. And so drawing on a number of British thinkers, most prominently Ruskin, whose book, Unto This Last Gandhi, translated as Sarvodaya, Progress for All, drawing on thinkers like Ruskin.
John Ruskin.
Gandhi was clear that what should motivate us are social affections, our desire to do good to each other. And because the British have lost sight of that, very far from being the most civilized nation on the earth, they are in fact the least civilized.
Yeah, and you just made reference to a point that you really emphasize in this chapter in the volume Constructing the Pluriverse, and that is that reason or empiricism wasn't everything for Gandhi. So was Gandhi actually denouncing reason, or was he saying that it must be supplemented by things such as what you were saying, the affective attachments, the emotional attachments, the spiritual side of human existence?
Well, he does think that they need to be supplemented. He is not against empiricism. He's not against rationalism. But he thinks that these alone are insufficient for effecting the kind of moral and political change needed to liberate us from the tiger's domain. So Gandhi is very much invested in verifying the results of what he called his experiments with truth. That's not to say that he was experimenting with lying, but his experiments with his ability to capture the multifacetedness of capital T truth. So that involved a certain degree of observation, attentiveness to how we lived our lives and the consequences of our actions. But underlying that, however, was a spiritual belief. And the spiritual belief, as I mentioned earlier, was that we are all part of one human family. And so Gandhi's epistemology is a combination of these two things, of a very fine-grained, at times obsessive, concern with empirical facts, but supplemented by the spiritual faith that, if done well, the results that we will arrive at are ultimately results that will confirm that we are all part of one family.
And by epistemology, you mean kind of his understanding of the nature of knowledge?
Yes, I mean, so epistemology, you know, how do we know what we know? So Gandhi's epistemology is concerned with figuring out, well, I have these spiritual beliefs. I believe something is good or bad. How do I know it? Gandhi says, I know it because I'm going to try and implement it in my own life and see what the consequences of that are.
Manu Samnotra, assistant professor of political theory at the University of South Florida. And we are talking about an article, a chapter about Gandhi's thought that he contributed to a volume. It's called Constructing the Pluriverse, The Geopolitics of Knowledge. We'll take a short break and return and speak more with Manu. Please stay with us. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Manu Samnotra joins me. He teaches political theory in the School of Interdisciplinary Global Studies at the University of South Florida. He is currently writing a book about Hannah Arendt and the political uses of shame, and he has contributed an article about Gandhi's thought. This is what we are discussing today. An article that appears in the new volume, Constructing the Pluriverse, The Geopolitics of Knowledge. It's edited by Bernd Reiter. So your emphasis on Gandhi's interest in experimentation really comes out in this chapter in this book. In fact, the title of Gandhi's autobiography is The Story of My Experiments with Truth, not my conclusions regarding truth or what I have set in stone in relation to truth. But of course, you know, a lot of political thinkers, political parties, political groupings, they have certain principles and ideas that they consider axiomatic. What would Gandhi think about that? Would he ever consider something to be so self-evident that one should simply accept it by virtue of having a political stance, being part of a political party, belonging to a certain kind of grouping?
Well, I mean, so if there's one group that Gandhi would certainly count himself as part of without any question regarding his allegiance to it, that would be truth. So, you know, I think I mentioned earlier he called himself a votary of truth. The problem at some level, however, being with being a votary of truth, is that, and it sort of goes back to the word satyagraha, if you are a votary of truth, which in the context of satyagraha means a firm grasping of truth, what is to prevent you, despite your pretensions to goodwill, from insisting on your truth and mistaking your truth for the larger truth, and similarly your political opponent from doing the same? And so this is a danger. This ideological entrenchment is a danger in all kinds of politics. And so therefore Gandhi, at the sort of abstract level, is very much committed to truth, but he understands that that truth is only accessible through dialogic engagement with others and through the practice of satyagraha, which in turn depends upon loosening or breaking the circuit of our desires through nonviolence, which in turn is dependent on learning ways in which we are already embedded in systems of violence and learning to control that, which involves self-rule. And so to answer your question whether Gandhi would ever take anything, any political position, as self-evident, I mean, sure, there are some, like, you know, that nonviolence is good, that following the truth is important, showing love and compassion towards your political opponent are necessary. But as a result, he also ends up with certain kinds of positions that his political colleagues often found baffling. So at several points, or at least at one very important point in the Indian independence struggle, there is an incident in a village where some villagers basically who have been, for the lack of a better word, oppressed by the British representatives there, take the law into their own hands and kill some Indian policemen. And in this large struggle, nationwide struggle that's going on there, this is one isolated incident of violence. And Gandhi, upon hearing about this, immediately calls off the non-cooperation movement, the larger movement that was going on at the time in the Indian political scene. And all his colleagues are flabbergasted because they think independence is so close at hand. And Gandhi says, I don't want that kind of independence. I don't want an independence that is premised on violence. They say to him, but it's an isolated incident of violence. This is not something that's, you know, is true for the larger struggle that's going on, which has been largely, entirely nonviolent. But Gandhi says, no, this is not sufficient. What it tells me is that we haven't learned to control our own passions. And until we do that, we will not actually get Swaraj. We won't get self-rule of the kind that I want. And so, you know, in some ways, Gandhi's commitment to truth, commitment to nonviolence, created political outcomes that were, from, you know, a more strategic perspective, counterproductive. And yet Gandhi was, his axiomatic commitment to these things and to learning the truth of his life through experiment remained unchanged. And that's, it's at one level, infuriating, because you, at least for me as a student of Indian history and as, you know, as an Indian citizen, I think to myself, oh my God, we could have had independence 15 years before, 20 years before we actually did. On another level, I'm blown away by the commitment of this man to his principles, which are good principles, the principles that I would want to, and I hope do, subscribe to.
In this chapter, you also discuss what Gandhi thought about grassroots decision-making, kind of small, village-oriented democratic decision-making versus state-level planning and decision-making. Did Gandhi favor one or the other?
Absolutely. This goes back again to his conclusions in Hind Swaraj, Indian Self-Rule, the book that we both mentioned earlier, where the reader wants to take on the infrastructure of the modern state as the British have developed it, implemented it in India, and simply remove the people who are in charge. And as I mentioned earlier, for Gandhi, that's not a solution, or that's certainly not independence, because even that system is premised on violence. What the state does very well is that it extracts resources from one place and legitimizes it through mechanisms, large-scale mechanisms, nationwide voting, that give it the patina of democracy. For Gandhi, that is not Swaraj. And so against a large state, Gandhi favored more village-based communities. And also, the small scale of these things has another advantage. Now, before I tell you what that advantage is, let me just say one other thing about many other political theorists. Plato, to take one example, Rousseau, to take another, and many others along the way and since then, have argued that if you want to have a polity, whether it's democratic or aristocratic in a good sense, like the best rule, regardless of which what the flavor is, if you want a good polity, it must be small in size. Because otherwise, if it's too large, as Plato once says, in the Republic, we're no longer working with one city, but with many cities. And that's not a solution. For Gandhi also, scale matters. Like I mentioned a moment ago, one reason is that the larger the scale, the easier it is to hide the violence that is sort of central to how the state operates. But the other part is related directly to the question of civilization that I mentioned earlier. If civilization is your ability to do your duty, our ability to understand our duty is heightened when we are able to deal with it not in an abstract sense, my duty to my nation, my duty to my race or my ethnicity, but my duty to this person or that person who I see before me. And so a village-level communities, democratic communities, would actually enable that performance of duty, which is at the core of civilization for Gandhi. And so compared to the modern state and its very large apparatus for making decisions at a grand scale, Gandhi prefers the humility of the small village-level communities.
And in preferring that, and in rejecting much of the crass materialism that came with modernity, with modern civilization as he saw it in the West, did Gandhi advocate for a return to a rustic past?
So that's a question that, I'll be honest with you, I'm not fully equipped to answer definitively. Part of the reason is, I mean, there's 98 volumes of Gandhi, so the things that he says are not always consistent and not always, you know, easily remembered by students, even the best students of Gandhi, and I'm certainly nowhere near that. But on another level, I think Gandhi was also willing to learn. And so I don't want to answer the question definitively because later on in his life, Gandhi acknowledged that there are some things that are important, some things that only a state can do that local village-level communities cannot. So just to give you an example, and lately this person has gained a lot of prominence amongst political theorists dealing with Indian political thought, and that is the great constitutionalist B.R. Ambedkar. So B.R. Ambedkar was himself from the untouchable castes. He was the most prominent leader of the untouchable castes and was in constant engagement with Gandhi on the question of caste. So remember, if Swaraj is about self-rule, it is not only about ascetic control over our desires, it's also about internal reform. The independent struggle is not just about what we do with regards to the British, but also about what we do with regard to our own practices. And so Gandhi, earlier on in his life, not very early, but somewhere in after he comes to India, he believes that untouchability is a sin. He believes that one should not practice it. In fact, there's an earthquake in the state of Bihar where lots of people die, and Gandhi says, much to the dismay of his colleagues, including Tagore, he says the earthquake occurred because Indians still practice untouchability. But what does one do about removing untouchability beyond simply saying that it is bad? At the village-level communities that I mentioned earlier that Gandhi was fond of, those practices were very deeply entrenched. And so over time, he recognizes that in some cases, the state is important, a body that will guarantee the rights of the people who are deemed untouchable and abolish untouchability. That is a necessary part of the vision of Swaraj that he imagines. But Gandhi doesn't say very much about that. And for his part, the moment independence happens, and most readers of that moment in Indian history agree, Gandhi is basically sidelined. Nehru, the first Prime Minister of India, almost chuckles at the strange notions Gandhiji has, and sort of insists on building a more secular industrial state in place of the vision that Gandhi himself advocated.
You write that Gandhi thought that satyagraha, this civil disobedience, although as you've mentioned, its meaning of it is much more complex and nuanced, that satyagraha could be practiced by Jews against the Nazis. So here we're talking about the wider applicability, the universality of Gandhi's strategy, at least in his own mind. Did people agree with Gandhi about the applicability, let's say in the case of the Holocaust or what led up to the Holocaust?
So that's actually a very complicated question regarding what Gandhi thought about the Holocaust or how to fight the Holocaust. The fact that it happened is abominable, and there's no question that Gandhi thought this way. The question, however, was posed to him in the late 30s, before the implementation of the Final Solution, which, of course, most people did not know about, including, in fact, Hannah Arendt. Most people did not learn about it, the full scale of what had happened, until after the war was over. So sitting in India, Gandhi has obviously no understanding of what's really going on. But at this point, the Nazis are expelling Jews, seizing their property. I think Kristallnacht happens as well during this time. And so someone asks Gandhi, well, what do you think Jews should do? And he says, they should practice satyagraha. If they truly went out on the streets and were humble and meek and showed that they loved the Nazis, they would convert the hearts of the Nazis. The Jewish philosopher, the great Jewish philosopher Martin Buber, who was quite fond of Gandhi, wrote to him, and I quote, satyagraha is testimony. Testimony without acknowledgement is martyrdom. So to quote Hannah Arendt again, what Arendt says about the Nazis is that what they wanted most to do is to push into what she calls, quote, holes of oblivion, any scenes of resistance. They wanted to cut away from human memory altogether any sense of hope, any sense of an alternative to what they had implemented. And so if what Buber says is true and what Arendt diagnoses about the Nazis after the war is true, then what Gandhi advocated would not have worked. And what it suggests is that for satyagraha to work, it requires as a precondition the commitment to the rule of law, if not the, you know, the rule of truth, as it were, the rule of law by the people we are opposing. And so the British were quite good targets of this, targets or subjects for implementing or experimenting with satyagraha, because they believed in the rule of law, or at least certainly wanted to maintain the veneer of it. The Nazis had no such compunctions about doing away with such appearances, at least as far as their Jewish populations were concerned. And so after the fact, you know, the whole horror of everything is revealed, then, or at least certainly in the midst of the Second World War, someone asks Gandhi again, well, what do you think about this? What do you think your system would have worked? Jews would have been mercilessly killed by the Nazis. And Gandhi, and this is a difficult thing to wrestle with, but Gandhi says, yeah, that may have happened, but you may have actually also succeeded in converting people. We do not know. In any case, how many more people did in fact die in the war? Could those deaths have been avoided? So it's a very weird kind of accounting that he's engaging in. He's saying, it seems to me on my interpretation of it, that if satyagraha had been implemented, people would have died, but not as many people would have died as did in the actual conflagration that took place during the Second World War. If that is what he's saying, then I personally am not very sympathetic to his calculus. On the other hand, he's throwing out a moral challenge to us, and he's saying, in effect, you can't expect your policies will fail unless you actually try them. Your strategies will fail unless you actually try them. And there's always space for trying to convert people's hearts. You have to believe that. That's his spiritual belief, and that people can be turned, can be convinced of the larger moral truth that we are all part of one human family.
So we've been talking about a lot this hour about political goals, about self-control, about, you know, ways of thinking, about interconnectedness, and ways of perhaps, in Gandhi's case, certainly disciplining one's body in the form of ascetic practices. So where did and how did Gandhi draw the balance between the effort to pursue political goals like emancipation and the effort to craft a better self, craft a better person? How important was one to the other in his eyes?
I think it is absolutely crucial to Gandhi's political practice that developing a better self, practicing self-control, understanding how our desires shape the way we perceive reality, the ends to which we are willing to devote ourselves, it's deeply important that attentiveness to these things be a part of any political program. Because if we do not pay attention to what it is we want and how it is that we came to want what we want, if we do not, to use that Socratic injunction, know ourselves, then we are trapped in cycles of violence that have been set in place long before us and will continue long after us. And so it is deeply important for Gandhi to practice an ethic of self-care in order to develop a self capable of entering the political realm. The self that thus enters the political realm, that is properly disciplined in its desires and in its wants, is better prepared to apprehend political reality, is better prepared to apprehend the structures of violence that make agency possible, and more importantly, from Gandhi's perspective, is able to turn the other person, convince the other person that, look, I'm not in this because I want something that's material that I will have at your expense. I'm here because I want for both of us to be better human beings, to be better in our ability to apprehend truth. And I can show you my love, Gandhi was saying to his opponent, by showing you that I do not care for myself, that I'm willing to, in fact, sacrifice myself. So Gandhi undertakes a few times in his career in India, he undertakes hunger strikes to atone for what he feels is the wrong that has been done in his name or in the interests of Indian politics to the opponent. And in this moment, Gandhi is saying, I'm so unconcerned with my well-being because I've disciplined my sense of well-being so well that my sacrifice for you is possible in the first place, is possible for me to do. But second, is meant to communicate to you that, that you are, in your soul, more important to me than something that you possess. And in the case of the British, your ability to rule India is not as important to me as my concern for your soul and for the soul of modern civilization, which is lost at the altar of expediency and at the altar of greed.
Manu Samnotra is his name. He teaches political theory in the School of Interdisciplinary Global Studies at the University of South Florida. And in the new volume, Constructing the Pluriverse, The Geopolitics of Knowledge, you will find a fascinating article, a chapter written by Manu about Gandhi's thought. It's called Experimenting with Freedom. That's what we've been talking about this hour. Constructing the Pluriverse is edited by Bernd Reiter, who is also, like Manu, a professor at the University of South Florida. It's published by Duke University Press. And again, you may want to look in the hopefully not too far future for a book by Manu about Hannah Arendt and the political uses of shame. Manu, thanks so much for your work and for this enlightening chapter and for joining us today.
Thank you so much, C.S. It was a pleasure being with you.
And this is C.S., suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.